Amen. Thank you very much, Bill, and it's great to be with you. The way it worked was something like this. I said to David that I would like to be here for the commissioning of Mark and Liz Featherston Hall as they go out to Cambodia, and it was to be at 11:30, and then he said, will you preach? And I said, yeah, may as well, that's great. And then I rang him up and I said, but does the same person not preach at 10 and 11:30? He said, yeah, I didn't like to get to ask you to do that, he said. And I said, okay, I'll do it. And he said, will there be Harley Davidson bikers here as well? But I've been totally let down because nobody has given me a leather jacket to wear. But maybe at the end of the service, you never know. You never know. I'll get one at the end, get a photograph with the Harley Davidson bikers. And I was told what passage I was to preach on. And I was told what the theme was, so that makes it very, very easy for me. The passage is Nehemiah chapter 2, which will come up on the screens, I presume. It's in the English Standard Version I'm reading from. And the theme about Nehemiah is the strategy he gained. And I think what I want to say first, before I even read the passage, though if you were here last week, you may well know this, that the books of Ezra and Nehemiah in the Bible go together. Essentially, what had happened was that the people of Israel had been taken into captivity by the Babylonians, and the Persians took over the Babylonians and created this big empire called the Persian Empire. And the people of Israel and Judah were in a province that was called Beyond the River. Now, what that meant was that the center of things were in Persia, and beyond this river, the Euphrates, was this little place that was considered to be relatively unimportant, beyond the river. Like, for example, in Ireland, you know the phrase, beyond the pale. That meant that if you lived outside the area around Dublin, you were totally unimportant, right? Or the phrase back of beyond was used by the English, right, to describe what it was like to live in the west of Ireland, where the only thing beyond there was the Atlantic Ocean, right? So beyond the river were God's people, the place God's people were, God had given to them, right? And that was over to the edge. And over here was the massive Persian Empire. And the book of Ezra tells us that 70 years after the people of Israel were taken into captivity, they began to go back. And under Ezra, they rebuilt the temple in Jerusalem. Yeah. But the work wasn't complete because the walls of the city hadn't yet been rebuilt. And that was the job that Nehemiah was called to do 70 years later. So that's just to give you a kind of sense of the story. So here we go with Nehemiah chapter 2. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had not been sad in his presence. And the king said to me, why is your face sad, seeing that you're not sick? This is nothing but sadness of the heart. Then I was very much afraid. I said to the king, let the king live forever. Why should not my face be sad, when the city, the place of my father's graves, lies in ruins, and its gates have been destroyed by fire? Then the king said to me, what are you requesting? So I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said to the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, that you sent me to Judah, to the city of my father's graves, that I may rebuild it. And the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, how long will you be gone, and when will you return? So it pleased the king to send me when I had given him a time. And I said to the king, if it pleases the king, let letters be given to me to the governors of the province beyond the river, that they may let me pass through until I come to Judah, and a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress of the temple and for the wall of the city and for the house that I shall occupy. And the king granted me what I asked, for the good hand of my God was upon me. Then I came to the governors of the province beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent with me officers of the army and horsemen, but when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant heard this, it displeased them greatly that someone had come to seek the welfare of the people of Israel. So I went to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. Then I arose in the night, I and a few men with me, and I told no one what my God had put into my heart to do for Jerusalem. There was no animal with me, but the one on which I rode. I went out by night by the valley gate to the dragon spring and to the dung gate, and I inspected the walls of Jerusalem that were broken down and its gates that had been destroyed by fire. Then I went to the fountain gate and to the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal that was under me to pass. Then I went up in the night by the valley and inspected the wall, and I turned back and entered by the valley gate and so returned. And the officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing. And I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, and the rest who were to do the work. Then I said to them, you see the trouble we are in, how Jerusalem lies in ruins with its gates burned. Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer suffer derision. And I told them of the hand of my God that had been upon me for good, and also of the words that the king had spoken to me. And they said, let us rise up and build. So they strengthened their hands for the good work. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they jeered at us and despised us and said, what is this thing that you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king? Then I replied to them, the God of heaven will make us prosper, and we his servants will arise and build. But you have no portion or right or claim in Jerusalem. It was absolutely joy to my ears to be asked to preach about strategy. Because I have discovered, in fact, I said it probably in a way that I wouldn't have said it if I'd thought about it, at a launch of a course on reconciliation by one of the clergy in the diocese with Evangelical Alliance, and it was done in the Dock Cafe last week, and a brilliant course. I have seen so many brilliant courses. And they're given out and everybody says, that is a wonderful course. And then they put it on a shelf and do absolutely nothing about it. Strategy, I looked up in the dictionary, is a plan of action designed to achieve a long-term aim. We are still footering around in Northern Ireland with the situation, great Northern Irish word, that we're in. We're footering around instead of actually putting in place the things that are required to transform and change things. We have a vision of peace. We have even a desire for peace, right? But the strategy is not there to make things change. Churches can be like that as well. And you know something? I'm just thinking, you see the Harley-Davidson bikers this morning, they don't come out if it's wet. Only the ones who are here come out if it's wet, because their bikes might get wet. That's what you've just told me, right? Isn't it? Is that true? Yeah, partially true at least, right? Like, what's a bike for? It's to get you from A to B, isn't it? You know, whether it's wet or dry, but they're maybe not very well made, those Harley Davidson or something like that. Could be something like that. Now, what I've got this morning for you, and you need to apply it to your situation. Mark, Phyllis and Ho down there will be applying it to going to Cambodia. Some people will be applying it to the church. Some people will be applying it to the Harley Davidson Bikers Club or whatever it is. Some people will be applying it to the politics of Northern Ireland in this week in which we have remembered the 20th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. But here is what Nehemiah has got to teach us about strategy. And it's in 10 points, but they'll not be very long points, so you'll not be here all day. But here they are. And you don't have to remember them. Don't even try to remember them. Just remember the story. And if you remember the story, the points will come to you just as the points came to me. Right. So here we go, first of all. Strategy is born in prayer and passion. Strategy only happens if we have an aim given to us that is somewhere out there that seems to a degree perhaps even impossible at the time. Strategy is only given to people who have got a sense that there is something which is on their hearts to do and to change. Without that, nobody will ever need strategy. And so Nehemiah, if you looked at chapter 1, you will discover has been several months in prayer and fasting. And what has been formed in him through the prayer and fasting is an absolute passion to see the work on Jerusalem completed and the walls rebuilt. And it's been formed in him in such a way that when he goes into the king, he can't keep it to himself. You see, like, you really could have had your head cut off for showing your emotions to the king. He didn't want to show his emotions to the king, but he couldn't do anything else, because God had formed in him through prayer a passion for the rebuilding of Jerusalem. Secondly, strategy is able to start from go. Is that what I've said up there? Did I say something different? Did I change it? Is able to start from where we are. Strategy is able to start from where we are. In Ezra 4, verse 21, there's a very interesting passage just before that, where the king has declared that the work in Jerusalem is to stop. Verse 21, therefore make a decree that these men be made to cease, that this city be not rebuilt until a decree is made by me, and take care not to be slack in this matter. Where Nehemiah is starting from is a place where nothing is to happen. Now, what happens with many of us when we get to a place where authority has declared that nothing is to happen? We get to the place then where nothing happens. Well, I couldn't possibly change that. Right? This is how it is in Northern Ireland, you know, all geographically divided up between Catholics, Protestants, Nationalists, Unionists, and all the rest of it. You know, that's just how it is. Right? Can't be different. Everybody wants it to be like that. Can't be any different. The political parties are at the two extremes and can't get anywhere, can't have Stormont, can't have an assembly, can't do this and can't do that, because there's somehow or other, there seems to be a power out there that has declared that things are frozen. And that's exactly where Nehemiah starts from. But his strategy starts from where it's at. You can't start a strategy from where you'd like it to be at, right? You can't start a strategy from where you would like things to be. A strategy is how you get things from where they are to where you believe under God they should be, and it always has to start from where things are, and we find that very difficult. Thirdly, strategy all knows the overall aim and keeps the overall aim in view. Chapter 2, verses 4 and 5. The king said to me, "What are you requesting?" So I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said to the king, "If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, that you sent me to Judah, to the city of my father's graves, that I may rebuild it." Strategy knows the overall aim. It keeps an eye on the overall aim. The overall aim doesn't change. You know, there are some people around who are not very strategic, perhaps, you know, and they're going for this aim one minute, and then they're passionate about that aim the next minute, and some other aim the next minute. Some, you know, people like that, maybe you're one of them. Maybe I'm one of them, right? But with Nehemiah, God calls him to do one thing. And if his eye is to be taken off that overall aim, that one thing, then the strategy isn't going to work at all. Fourthly, strategy is practical and compromises. It makes compromises. That's not a very popular word in Northern Ireland. I always like to think of myself as a compromiser. Right? As a compromiser. I think compromising is a very healthy thing, right? I wish to goodness that our first deputy first minister would think that compromising was a very good thing. We'd be in a different place than we're in today, right? Compromising is a good thing. And what happens, you see, in verses, chapter 2, verse 6, is that a kind of compromise is made. How long will you be gone, and when will you return? Well, I'm sure that Nehemiah wanted to say forever. I don't really want to come back to this place. I really want to be where God's people are meant to be. But he doesn't say that. So it pleased the king to send me when I had given him a time. And I said to the king, "If it pleases the king, let letters be given to me," and so forth. He's prepared to compromise to get this particular building block of where he's going to go into place. And I think we should not see compromise as a dirty word. I think there are wrong compromises, don't get me wrong, on really critically important things. But there are very important compromises in making strategy possible. Fifthly, strategy chances your arm. Now, your rector is very good at chancing his arm. I think he's really good. He will go up to anybody and he will ask them anything, even for anything. That's a wonderful gift to have. And I'm not really like that. I don't like to do that, you know, but here's what happens in verse 7. I said to the king, "If it pleases the king, let letters be given to me to the governors of the province beyond the river, so that they may let me pass through until I come to Judah." Right. He's kind of pushing his luck a wee bit, isn't he? You know, he's actually not just wanting the king to let him go. He's wanting the king to put into place all the things that are necessary to let him go safely and arrive safely and achieve what he's going to achieve. And sometimes we don't like to. We think we just breathe a sigh of relief that the king hasn't chopped our head off or whatever it is, and that he's going to let us go. But he actually pushes his luck. And I think there's a very godly Christian aspect, especially with the world around us. There's a godly Christian aspect in pushing our luck a little bit, if that's not the wrong thing to say in church, because of course there's no such thing as luck really, but in pushing the boundaries a little bit and in getting the authorities who potentially can make things happen on side. Sixthly, strategy gathers, finds, strategic leaders find resources to achieve their aim. Right? Chapter 2, verse 8. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, so that he may give me timber and make beams for the gates of the forest of the temple and for the wall of the city and for the house I shall occupy. Strategic leaders chance their arm, and strategic leaders find the resources to make their goal possible. One of the great strategic leaders that I know is John Key, who started Summer Madness how many years ago? 30 years ago. John was just an incredible person at not only having the vision and the aim clear, but also at chancing his arm to get people on side and gathering around him all the resources, so that what was a dream and what was a vision and what was an impossibility, and he did this in the early days with no money. In fact, he chanced all his own family money. Not that that was very much, I don't think, at the time, to make it possible. He put his neck on the line and he gathered the resources and he was able to make a dream into a reality. Number 7, strategic leaders steer a straight course through opposition. Chapter 2, verse 9, first of all. Then I came to the governors of the province beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now, the king had sent with me officers of the army and horsemen, but when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant heard of this, it displeased them greatly that someone had come to seek the welfare of the people of Israel. And then in verse 19, but when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they jeered at us and despised us and said, "What is this thing you're doing?" I don't know what God is calling you to do in and with and through your life. I don't know what the big aim or the big goal is for you. Maybe you don't know either. Sometimes there are stages in our lives where we don't. But you see, when you do, you see, when you become clear about what God is calling you to do, like Mark and Liz are going off to Cambodia, right? Do you know, I'm going to tell you something, you're going to find opposition. Mark, I can promise you that. I often say to people when they're ordained, there's only one thing I can promise you, and it's tears. There'll be tears. There will be people who will oppose you from the right and oppose you from the left, and the most wonderful gift of the Holy Spirit is to be able to walk right through it with determination. I don't mean not to listen to criticism, because we all need to listen to criticism. I don't mean not to listen to proper criticism, but I mean that when people are simply battering you, opposing you, determined to stop you, determined to jeer at you, determined to put you off track, the most important thing a leader can do is be determined to walk right through it. I've known that in my own ministry at different times. I've known it in my own. I didn't know I was doing it perhaps when I was doing it. I didn't know I was doing it when I was doing it, because being battered from both sides is not easy. And, you know, bishops get it quite a bit, because you find yourself brought in the most intractable of situations where this side wants A and this side wants B. And you see, when you go in, you're the enemy of both. But the good thing is you can go home at the end of the day, whereas a rector can't. Right? So it is really, really important to know that strategic leaders steer a straight course through opposition. We're getting near the end. Strategic leaders get key people on board quietly first. From verse 11 onward, so I went to Jerusalem, was there 3 days, then I arose in the night. I and a few men with me. And I told no one what my God had put into my heart to do for Jerusalem. And then it goes on about inspecting the walls, observing what is with this few people. And at the end of that passage, I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, and the rest who were to do the work. When God calls us to work strategically for Him, it's important to work out in circles. Right? To tell the people we can really trust first. To get their steer on it. To look at the situation with them as it is, not as we would like it to be, but the situation we're actually going to have to deal with, and to gather around us almost in ever-growing concentric circles the kind of support that is necessary to build this new city, or rebuild this city and rebuild these walls. Now, I'm wondering as I'm talking about this, what it means for us in Northern Ireland, what it means for you in Willowfield, because you have this fabulous church which is situated right in the middle of East Belfast, right? You have done what Ezra did. You have built the temple first. You have taken time to build the church. You've now built the halls as well. So how do you rebuild the community in which we're situated? I know that's in your heart, and I know that you're doing many things to do it, but it's really important that we keep on track and gather people around us in concentric circles who can enable things to happen. And then number 9, strategic leaders choose the right moment to inspire publicly, verses 17 and 18. Then I said to them, you see the trouble we're in, how Jerusalem lies in ruins with its gates burned. Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no more suffer derision. Let us rise up, it says in verse 18, and build. There comes the moment to gather the people and to get the people to actually rise up with all the foundations, as it were, in the planning that needed to be done to make it actually happen. And then the last one is this. Godly strategy is infused with God the whole way through. And so there's a kind of rhythm in this chapter in Nehemiah, chapter 2, verse 4b. So I prayed to the God of heaven, verse 8b, for the good hand of my God was upon me. Verse 18, and I told them of the hand of my God that had been on me for good. And verse 20, the God of heaven will make us prosper. So back to what strategy is. Strategy is a plan of action designed to achieve a long-term aim. There are churches, nations, organizations, people's lives, and we are some of them. And we've lived our lives with a sense that God may call us or be calling us to do something very clear and very specific and even absolutely impossible for Him. We've had the vision. We have, like Martin Luther King, dreamed the dream. But we haven't put the strategy in place or ensured the strategy is put in place to make it actually happen. And the story of Nehemiah chapter 2 is that with God as part of the rhythm of that, it can actually happen. The walls actually were rebuilt under Nehemiah against all the opposition, against all the odds, with all the challenges. And I just want to say to you, whether you're interpreting this as an individual, part of a club, part of a church, or politically in Northern Ireland, or whatever it is, if God gives you that vision, yes, check it out, make sure it's true, but don't give up on it, right? And if you're thinking that there is some kind of aim, some kind of vision that has been formed in you and that has been ditched halfway through, get back to it quickly now. Get back to it quickly now. Don't make anybody else have the responsibility for making it happen. You take the responsibility to make it happen. And by the grace of God, then the most amazing things can take place. Let's bow our heads in prayer.